what is our responsibility to other species? Is it stewardship? Dominion? Are they the same thing? Are there just too many people? Is it us or them? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today I hope we will have a stimulating discussion of extinction to get beyond the controversy over the Endangered Species Act. The telephone line 1-800-478-8255, that's 478-TALK, and Anchorage a local call at 550-8422, and there's always the email. Beluga days and polar bears on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Well, it was a clear cut. In the area where I grew up around the turn of the century, the Allegheny Plateau was a great place for stuff like hemlock bark that was used for tanning leather and for big tall white pines that were used for the masts of ships. A few years back, I went back to the Allegheny Plateau and had the pleasure of seeing the first successful nesting bald eagles in I don't know how many years. They had finally come back. Of course, they're coming back all over the lower 48 now. But this is a species that we almost made extinct. And I remember distinctly in the early 60s when Silent Spring came out by Rachel Carson, and she talked about how DDT was causing the problems for all sorts of birds, that I made fun of her. I thought this is just whiny, do-goody kind of stuff. Later on came Save the Whales and all the rest of it, animal rights. But I was fairly cynical about that, much to my embarrassment now. And I would make fun of Rachel Carson. And we did almost make the eagles extinct. I also remember it was my people who had a big hand in getting rid of the passenger pigeon. One of the first sagas of extinction. These were birds that were in flocks of so many millions that they just simply darkened the skies, and they're completely extinct now. The last one died around 1914. But long before that, there were hardly any. Because they were so easy to catch. And the people of my country in the Allegheny Plateau, and there's photographs in the Historical Society Museum of these nets that they put up to catch them as they flew along the hilltops. It was no problem. Or you could smoke up the trees at night and they'd drop out. They won't be able to hold on, drop out. And they would sell these as squab to the urban markets. They probably needed the money. Within my own memory, I remember the shang diggers. They figured out there was wild ginseng growing in the hills where I grew up. And so all these people came around and they dug it up. You can't find it anymore. There may be one or two people that know a few secluded places where the shang will come back, but they're certainly not telling anybody. I'm hoping that our listeners can reflect personally on this issue of causing another species to go extinct. I know it's asking a lot because it's all over the news. It's everywhere. I mean, let's face it, if we're putting too many greenhouse gases into the air and we're causing the ice all over the north to melt, there's likely to be extinctions. We're certainly making things very difficult for all sorts of seals and the polar bears that eat the seals and the walruses and so forth. And those are just the ones we know about. There's all the ones we don't know about, and we'll probably get into that sort of thing as well. I know and I hope that some will call who are vegetarians for ethical reasons. I think it would be very interesting to hear the testimony of somebody who has decided that they'll do less harm to other species by not eating meat. Because that seems to be many people. Some are doing it for health reasons. Some are doing it for a combination. Some are doing it because they just want to lessen their imprint on other species. And I wonder if this is an emerging ethic, because it certainly wasn't around when the Shang diggers were coming up to my area of the country. So I have some guests who I know are very thoughtful about these things and also very hardworking. From Homer, Alaska, let's welcome Nancy Lord, the author of Beluga Days. Nancy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Nancy is not just the author of Beluga Days. She's one of Alaska's best writers. She kept a fish camp for years and years on the Tyonek side of Cook Inlet, and she wrote an excellent book about that. And in a way, wouldn't you say that Beluga Days kind of came out of the meditations that prompted your book, Fish Camp?
It did. I actually had a chapter in Fish Camp called Beluga Days, and expanded into a full book.
I'm thinking that what we want to talk about is the subject of that book, in part, and because the Cook Inlet variant or population of belugas is unique. It's a distinct and unique population. There's a controversy now about whether it should be listed as endangered or not. And, you know, it's kind of a heartbreaking thing. And I think it's 100 times more poignant if someone has read your book, Nancy, because you have become so interested in this and put so much research into it that, believe it or not, you're an expert.
Some people think so. And people, every time someone sees belugas along turning an arm or so, people feel compelled to let me know. So I seem to be a sort of repository for beluga sightings and so on these days.
You know, I one time had Bernd Heinrich on this show, and he's a great expert on ravens. And I tried to get him to speak from his expertise on ravens, and all he wanted to hear is what Alaskans had to say about ravens. So I'm totally relating to what you're talking about here. Okay, Nancy, I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. I want to go to our other guest who's been on the show several times, Margaret Williams of the World Wildlife Fund. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Nancy.
Margaret, the reason I have you on this time is because you are kind of on the front of this issue on the polar bears. Not so much as a political issue, although I'm sure you don't hesitate to engage there, but on the biological part of it. And I understand that you were able to do some flying up there recently to see if you could find more swimming polar bears in the areas where the ice has pulled out.
That's true. I was just in the Arctic a week ago and a week before that, and so I'm looking forward to sharing what I saw, and also I would be really interested in hearing some other Alaskans share their polar bear observations and what they're seeing and what they're thinking about how we can plan for a future of very different ice coverage and increasing human polar bear interactions.
Do you? I know the World Wildlife Fund is a worldwide organization. People in your organization concerned about this big break off of the Ellesmere ice shelf that just happened?
Absolutely, that was just another huge piece of news on top of already remarkable news that we have reached. We've come very close to reaching last year's historical record of low minimum sea ice coverage in the summer. So we are just very, very concerned. And what the scientists have predicted through their models is being borne very true, although at a faster rate than anyone had expected. So it is a huge concern. And the Arctic is a focus for World Wildlife Fund. We have people working on the ground in all of the Arctic countries. We work in communities. We work at the governmental level. And so we're really, like many other conservation groups and governments and communities, really grappling with the incredible rapid changes in the Arctic.
Yeah, I think for many of our listeners, the best thing I could do is point them to the Snow and Ice Data Center's animation that shows how the sea ice withdraws and projections of the withdrawal. And what you see real quickly is that it all ends up in this area around, you know, this the last bastion of it is this area around Ellesmere Island. And now a big hunk of that ice shelf has suddenly broken off. So it's almost like, and this has happened over and over again, we didn't have models to predict this. It's going faster than any model predicted.
That's true. Even in August alone, we lost 28% of the sea ice coverage. That's a huge, huge expanse of ice and at an incredible rate. So these changes are, as you say, are quite dramatic and happening very rapidly.
Well, the calls are already starting to come in, and the telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, you can call locally at 550-8422, and you can also email, which later on when it gets a little bit more crowded, you may want to try talk@aprn.org. And, I usually get to read them, but when they come in late, sometimes I miss them, which is too bad because they're always great comments, and sometimes we just don't have time for them. So we'd appreciate your call early in the show. I think you've got some idea of where we're going to focus. Let's go now to Eric, who joins the program from Kenai. Eric, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thank you very much. And this is really a great topic. One of the questions I have, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I remember in high school, overpopulation was a problem that was talked about widely, and it was zero population growth was a big thrust back then, and it seems like the whole emphasis toward zero population growth has just kind of fizzled out over the years, and clearly it's having a big impact on the species extinction. And I'm just wondering, what's it going to take for people to realize that overpopulation in just about every area is one of the root causes of practically all our problems.
Yes, Eric, I think that the issue of what is the carrying capacity of the planet for the number of human beings is being intensely gone over. Obviously, many of us are way more consumptive of resources than we really need to be, and that's a really critical metric and all that. But I know that many believe that there are just simply too many people on the planet right now, and we're crowding out other species.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Eric, thank you very much for your call, and I expect we will revisit that later on in the program. 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and it's talk@aprn.org. Let's go ahead and get in touch with Sean in Haines. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska, Sean.
Yes, and thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of observations and that I'd just like to talk about. One is that I think it's long overdue that we change the Environmental Species Protection Act.
The Endangered Species Act,
Endangered Species Protection Act, because it as a management tool, as a regulatory tool, it is a sledgehammer when, in many cases, a scalpel would be the preferred instrument.
I think managers would somewhat agree with you, but they're scared to death of what it would be replaced with. I think where I first noticed that, oh boy, this ain't working so well, was when they started realizing that all the salmon species were different, all the salmon populations were different. It wasn't just species, and they got a judge to say that a salmon population was a population needed to be protected as a distinct entity under the ESA, and it just seemed, well, where is this going to end? I knew that was a problem. I know also that it's extremely vulnerable because of the burden of proof issue, which a lot of people don't understand, and which I think anybody that does understand doesn't want the burden of proof part of it changed, is makes it vulnerable to a lot of propaganda thrusts. And we saw that all the way back to Proxmire and the Golden Fleece and the very idea that you could stop human progress because of the snail darter that went on and on and on and on.
Yeah, and I think that it leads to a lot of dramatic and unnecessary political brinksmanship, because it is such a huge thing when a species or a population gets listed under the ESA, and it means that you've got a lot of really bad science and political interference with science taking place because it has no flexibility, and it needs to have that.
Yeah, Margaret is madly signaling that she wants to respond. Do you want to stay on, Sean? I think we have your point here, but you're welcome to stay on if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd just like to make one last observation.
Sure.
That is that it's really hard in the time span that we're talking about in the human perspective to keep things in perspective as well, that species have gone extinct long before we came onto the Earth, and they'll be going extinct long afterwards. And to think that we can save every animal all the time, I think, is disingenuous at best.
Okay, thank you, Sean. If you'd like to stay on, Margaret, I can
I'll
see.
I'll go ahead and just listen to the rest of the program. Thanks for taking my call.
All right, Sean. Thanks for your thoughts.
Well, Steve,
I'm sure you hear that a lot, Margaret.
Well, I would just say that the Endangered Species Act is a very important management tool, and it's unfortunate that there's a lot of misinformation about it being an overused tool or an inappropriate tool or a hammer. There are many different stages of what we call consultations that are conducted when a species is proposed to be listed. And it's a series of checks and balances which allows for science to be part of the process. It also allows for public participation to be part of the process. And it allows for socioeconomic concerns when a species is listed. So some people erroneously think that the Endangered Species Act shuts down all kinds of economic development. And in fact, the government has shown, government accounting office through various studies have shown that very, very small percent of projects are stopped. Very few impacts are actually highlighted through this process. So the ESA, it's really a series of checks and balances. It's an insurance policy. And just last night here on KSKA, you had the Line 1 Health Connection show. And Dr. Devra Davis, I believe, was cancer expert.
What a privilege to have that person come to Alaska.
She was great. And she talked about she was talking about public health, nothing to do with endangered species, but she talked about the precautionary principle and how important it is to be safer than being safer than sorry. And that's what the Endangered Species Act is. It's a way to ensure that we are not destroying our species and our habitats. And it's a complicated process, but I think it's a mistake to say that it's a hammer and that it's overused. And yes, species have gone extinct throughout the history of the planet, but at no time have species gone extinct at the rate of which we're seeing now because of human activity. And I really think if humans have been part of the problem, as a good colleague of mine says, humans can be part of the solution.
You're not opposed to having more tools, are you?
I think there are all kinds of tools, and I think it's really important for the public to participate in the process and for communities and individuals to be involved. So there are lots of different opportunities to participate and in the endangered species listing process, in public commenting processes, and it's really great we're having this show because I think people feel that it's beyond them, it's intimidating, but it's really quite accessible.
Well, I think the best shot of changing it was Pombo, and he turned out to be corrupt. He turned out to have to go to jail. I really think that, we're in a situation where the attempt to change it didn't work. The people who believe in it are very much united behind it at this point, and I think we're kind of, whether it's a blunt instrument or not, they're going to be very resistant to any kind of change right now, which is maybe good, maybe bad.
Well, unfortunately, right now there is an attempt to make another change to the Endangered Species Act, which would remove some of those important checks and balances. And World Wildlife Fund is really very much opposed to that.
Yeah, well, hopefully we won't have to talk about that because we'll use up the rest of the show. Nancy Lord, anything you wanted to toss in at this point before we start with some other stuff?
I agree completely with what Margaret said there so eloquently. And the ESA really has quite a good record when species have been listed. There have been some good successes, and I would point to the in Alaska, the Aleutian Canada goose, for one, that was listed and then has recovered and was removed from the list. And it doesn't... I think it's quite a reasonable thing to do, if, as Margaret says, if we have contributed, as we did in that case with introducing foxes to islands that birds used for nesting, to reverse the situation and remove the foxes and recover the goose species.
Okay, well, let's get a little closer to home to the belugas then. Here we have a population. If you look on the circumpolar map, which you provide with your book, you quickly see that... The Cook Inlet belugas are quite an isolated population. Do we have any idea how long they have been an isolated population?
Well, they've been doing some really interesting genetic work on all the beluga populations now. And I think as far as we know, they've been isolated from the other Alaska belugas for at least 10,000 years.
Wow.
And if I can just tell a little anecdote from last summer. I mean, they've been separated so long that they've clearly evolved distinctly to fit their particular environment with, you know, Cook Inlet with the huge tides and the shallow waters and so on. And
they don't, and Cook Inlet is extremely turbid, is that the word? It's muddy, murky. It's
right.
No visibility at all.
Right. And belugas are already known to be the marine mammal with the most sophisticated navigational system, sonar system. So there's a lot of value there. And last summer, I was with some people from the Ocean Futures Society who were making a film. And we spent a couple of days in the upper inlet kind of floating around with a hydrophone and listening to them. And the sound guy there, it was the fifth population that he's recorded of belugas. And he was just awestruck because the Cook Inlet belugas had more different kinds of noises that they were making compared to any of the other populations. And I've listened for a while too. And I mean, they make clicks and wheezes and buzzes and you know, all kinds of noises. But it may be that they have really, you know, that they have a communication system that's very, very sophisticated, more than other populations. And it would be a shame, you know, to lose that before we even understand what it's about.
You know, Nancy, what's striking me is, as you're talking, is that we hardly even know these animals, and they're at risk of extinction. We hardly even know them.
That's true. I always called them, you know, the mystery whales, and just in quite recent years have they even begun, the researchers, to you know, to understand some of the basic ecology of them. And until a few years ago, we didn't even know where they went in the winter. People thought they went out into the Gulf of Alaska. Now we know from the tagging studies that they stay up in the upper inlet under the ice a lot of the time.
Well, my personal memory is basically when they put the bike trail through around Point Warren's off there in Anchorage, and there's a point where it goes right close to the bluff, and that's a nice spot. I've always liked that spot because the airplanes take off. They're coming in, they're right on top of you. And so I was lying there waiting for the next plane to go over, and I'm hearing all this breathing, and I can't figure out where it's coming from. I don't hear any water lapping or anything, just breathing. And I finally look over, and it's our friends, the belugas, you know, and they're all over the place down there. There's something there for them to eat, fish, no doubt. And they were just all over the place. And you know what? That's the last time I saw them.
Hmm.
And you write sort of the same thing. They were all over the place. I was used to hearing them. And then all of a sudden, they weren't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then you try and trace, well, what happened to them? And it's not an easy tale. But do you think, I mean, here's clearly a case where ESA wasn't that much help, or MMPA, you know, for lack of enforcement, for lack of budget, for whatever reasons, a million reasons, for the fact that, you know, so many more Native people were moving to Cook Inlet and harvesting belugas without anybody noticing.
Well, yeah, clearly the Marine Mammal Protection Act wasn't adequate, and they have yet to be listed on the Endangered Species Act, although the science should be clear on that. And there will be a decision on that by October 20th is the deadline. But it's been a very long time of delay and inaction really. I would lay the blame with the National Marine Fisheries Service for being so incredibly slow to take any protective actions.
And yet you write sympathetically of them, by and large, in your book.
I do. I think, you know, on the individual people, I think are well-intended and you know, hardworking and so on. But as an institution, it's ineffective.
Yeah. Margaret Williams, I'm picking up the impression that really, if we did other preventive things, the Endangered Species Act could be more regarded as a means of last resort.
Well, in many ways, listing a species is a last resort, and World Wildlife Fund's mission is to prevent species from joining that list, really. What we'd like to do is find solutions ahead of time that prevent these species declines, and sometimes it is the right thing. With the polar bear, I think there was really no question there that the species needed to be listed. The science was compelling. There was enough science, and so
I was afraid you were going to bring that up.
Well, it is unfortunate. I mean, what is a world without polar bears? What is an Arctic without polar bears?
No, we have to bring it up. I understand, but by applying the Endangered Species Act, then you're saying, oh, it's climate warming. All the other countries are also responsible for climate warming. So why is it us on our little Endangered Species Act that has to be the instrument? And we can go down a huge rabbit trail with that, which I hope we don't.
I could give another example where I think things...
Okay, go ahead.
For example, we've been working quite a lot. World Wildlife Fund and the Nature Conservancy and other conservation groups have been working with our friends and colleagues out on the Pribilof Islands, where there's a concern about northern fur seals. And the Stellar Sea Lion listing created a lot of chaos and a lot of hard feelings and confusion, and decisions ended up being made by the court, fisheries management decisions. And so several years we got together and said, okay, let's work together, all the entities of the Pribilof Islands, all the management agencies, conservation groups. Let's look at the science to see what's happening with the northern fur seal. Let's exchange information. We had fishery industry leaders going out to the Pribilof Islands, learning about subsistence. We had community members meeting and learning about, you know, pollock trawlers. And it really helped to increase our common knowledge about what was happening with the species. We were able to have a dialogue and a discussion, which never happened during the Stellar Sea Lion process. Not to say that the Stellar Sea Lion listing was a mistake. I think that was also a last resort. But I think when there is a signal in the environment that something is amiss, we need to get on it. We need to get the best science possible. And we need to commit the resources to monitoring species. Sometimes we don't know enough science. We just have these little blips of data, and we need that long-term information. And we also need communities and all the different interest groups talking together. And I really think that's, from the Arctic, the bowhead whale story showed how important community input and native knowledge was to reporting on the status of the bowhead whale. That was very important. And I think in Alaska, we have a great opportunity to do more of that. We have more species. We have a healthier marine environment. And so I hope that we can continue to develop those kind of cases where people are working together to develop solutions.
Katie and Homer, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi.
Hiya.
Yeah, I just thought it was rather interesting. You got me right off when you, at your introduction, you said it's between us or them. And,
yeah, that's why they pay me the big bucks around here.
Yeah, well, my thought is that's the biggest myth man has had since he's industrialized himself and lived in cities is that it's us or them. It's actually us and them because we can't survive without the animals. Even though we've separated ourselves into cities and we're dependent on our oil and all this mechanical stuff that we have all around us, we still can't do without the plankton and the fish and the basic infrastructure of our earth that makes it possible for animals to exist on the earth so that we can have something to eat and wear and support the ecosystem of the earth, because it's all really interrelated.
Oh, Katie, thank you so much. That was very well put.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Nancy. I'm sure you would like to respond to that, but I want to take a break first as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Tell Alaska, encouraging listeners to tune to AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes. Tell Alaska on the web at tellalaska.com.
We're talking about extinction today on Talk of Alaska. It's fascinating. It seems we have quite a bit of potential extinction going on in Alaska. Some of it may be irreversible. A good example would be the Cook Inlet beluga whales, although the population appears to have stabilized somewhat. It hasn't shown recovery, and that puts it at risk, according to the actuarial work by the National Marine Fisheries Service. Our guests are Margaret Williams of the World Wildlife Fund and Nancy Lord, author of Beluga Days and former keeper of a fish camp over on the west side of Cook Inlet. Nancy, our last caller was pretty eloquent about the interrelatedness of things and the idea that it can't be us or them because you can't separate them. We would pay a price for any extinction we exact.
Yes, I thought that was very well said. And I think if you look at these issues just from a very selfish point of view, we don't know what these different species, what their value is to us, and if they disappear on our watch, we don't know what we might be losing. I mean, there might be, you know, some little plant that's got a cure for cancer or whatever. So we have sort of an obligation to try not to lose parts of the system. If we lose a sort of keystone species like belugas or polar bears, there could be, you know, cascading effects all through the system.
That's a really good point because that's what basically the NAS study on the Bering Sea ecosystem came up with, that there had been, among other things, a cascade because of the removal of the top predators. And, it's not well understood. Bering Sea is a lot bigger than people can understand, I think. But, that was part of their best guess. And, Nancy, another thing I wanted to go into with you on that is that what that argument goes around to is the next generation blaming us, for extinctions that we might have caused unthinkingly or heedlessly or through our wasteful practices or poor management or whatever, or poor stewardship. But my generation can look back at the people that wiped out the passenger pigeon or the almost wiped out the bald eagle. And you have a much closer example with your great friend, George, over there on the west side of Cook Inlet, who used to do everything he could to get rid of belugas because they ate salmon and he was fishing for salmon. So why shouldn't he? And we used to have a philosophy of predator control that was extremely widespread in Alaska.
We certainly did, and we still have that philosophy in many quarters about predator control. And yes, belugas were seen as predators in Cook Inlet and elsewhere. I think we've gotten a little smarter and are understanding how everything ties together, and the beluga is a necessary part of the system. We can manage to live with it.
Yeah, but also George admitted in his later years that probably the belugas weren't really depleting his fish catch that much.
Right. No, and actually, George Hayden, my neighbor over there, he was incredibly fond of the belugas, and I've noticed that from most fishermen that I've known, that they haven't really seen them as competitors. They enjoy seeing them when they see them and being out among them and watching them and knowing that we're all kind of part of everything out there.
Well, you also point to what little scientific work was done on whether or not they're competing with the commercial fishing fleet out in Bristol Bay. And actually, once they figured out what was going on, they didn't have to kill them. There were other measures that worked, right?
Yeah, there were some studies done where the belugas were eating salmon, and especially salmon smolt coming out of the rivers, and they devised noisemakers and so on to keep them from eating too much of what they didn't want them feeding on right away. So there are alternatives.
Yeah,
but one of the things I come back to in my book and elsewhere, I mean, I grew up on the East Coast as well, and was, you know, was aware of you know what we lost back there. And I often think about Beluga Point, and in, you know, in the future when people drive down Cook Inlet and go by Beluga Point, and I imagine, you know, children in the future would you know say, well, what, you know, I wonder why it's called Beluga Point. And you know, we know, but you know, some, you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, it might be just like all those, you know, Bear Creeks and Eagle Bluffs and all the things that are named for animals in the rest of the country, that they're just names, and they're not associated with anything that actually lives there anymore.
Let's go to Phil, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Phil. Well, we lost Phil. Too bad. Oh. He was going to talk about polar bears. Phil, maybe we can get you back, because I think you had a very good point. I'm going to turn to polar bears anyway, because Margaret Williams just got back from two different flights looking for swimming polar bears in the withdrawing sea ice in the Arctic Ocean, I guess primarily Chukchi or Chukchi and Beaufort?
Chukchi primarily, yes.
And why don't you tell us what you found? I mean, as I understand, you were prompted because one of these boats that was out doing transects looking for bowhead whales, and when they came through, ended up spotting quite a few swimming polar bears.
Yes, it was actually an aerial survey being conducted by as a joint study of the National Marine Mammal Lab, which is part of NOAA, and the Minerals Management Service, as a precursor to the oil development, which is planned for the area. And what was unusual was on August 16th, on a day when, again, they were looking for bowhead whales, 9 polar bears were sighted in open water. And compared with years of previous aerial surveys, sighting 9 polar bears in one day, it was quite a large number, whereas I think there was another study for over 16 years, just 12 bears were sighted in that period versus 9 bears in one day is quite a lot.
Now, you know, there's listeners right now who are saying, look, there's ice there, there's bears there, they're swimming, they swim all the time.
Yes.
What's the big deal? And the big deal, as I understand, is that they weren't anywhere near a food source.
Well, not completely.
They weren't anywhere near shore.
They weren't. What is unusual, and absolutely, polar bears swim long distances, and they can be strong swimmers. But what's unusual, these observations are coming at a time when we're seeing record low minimum sea ice coverage, and we're seeing very poor ice. And so I did you asked me about the flights. I did one coastal flight from Barrow down to Cape Lisburn. We saw 2 bears on land and no bears coming in, no bears swimming anywhere near shore. The following week, I went out with the U.S. Coast Guard, and we flew initially from Kodiak. But from Barrow, we at about 60 miles offshore from Barrow, we immediately saw a mom and a cub just swimming in open water. They had been, it looked like they were coming from an area of open water toward this very spotty sea ice. And it was, we flew over a lot of open water. And that was really remarkable to see this vast, dark blue space of nothing, but then a ribbon of ice, broken ice, as though someone had poured a snow cone along this vast ocean. So very small pieces of ice, icebergs. And this is where the mom and the cub were swimming. And sure, they may be able to pop up on one of those little icebergs, but the water is right now, because we're still in the melting season, the water is warming the ice from beneath. And so the big question is, because this ice is in such poor condition, will it last for the next few weeks as the melting ice, as the melting season continues? There was that ribbon of ice. We flew another 100 or so miles, and there was another ribbon of ice. There was also a large, I would say, ice platform several miles long and about a mile wide, and that was in very deep water. So out of the productive, out of the range of productive waters where there would be fish and seals and therefore prey for polar bears, what we didn't see really much life way out in the deep basin area. As we came back closer to the continental shelf, again, where this is rich, productive marine environment, that's where we started to see more polar bears. So in total, we did see 5 polar bears, and we saw thousands of walruses. again, because it's a rich environment. And the walruses, just like the polar bears, depend on the ice. And they were all, the walruses were all sort of crowded on these little ice platforms. And we have the same concern. If the ice is melting beneath the polar bears, it may be, it is melting beneath the walruses. And the walruses need this platform to raise their young, to rest, to dive and to feed in the rich deep water environment. So that is, we literally could see, this is really blew my mind to see an iceberg calving as though you can see a glacier calving. We would see these crumbling as the waves hit the icebergs, the sides of the icebergs erode. And if you get a storm, you know, in the next month, that those could storms could also erode the ice even more. So anyway, the bottom line is the Arctic is changing very, very quickly. And what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It really has impacts beyond Alaska, really throughout the whole planet. So we Alaskans are here at the front lines, and we're seeing these changes just before our eyes.
Thank you very much. That was a compelling description. I appreciate you going back to that for all of our listeners. Margaret Williams of the World Wildlife Fund. Let's go to Kathy, joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Kathy.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm very glad
yeah.
you called.
Well, you're glad I called because I'm one of those vegetarians.
Right.
And, I years ago looked at one of my dogs and I just thought, you know, I wouldn't eat them. So how can I eat these other critters that are out there? And that sort of, then I sort of took a vegan stand, and I try to be a vegan, which means I don't, unless it, it's hard in social situations, but I try not to use any animal products or eat animal products or wear animal products. And when Katie from Homer, you know, really prompted me to call when she said, you know, the animals are here for us to eat and you know, to wear. And I thought, okay. That's it. I got a call.
I appreciate it. So it's not for you. It's almost a one-on-one thing that you don't want to harm animals. Period.
Right. Period. Right.
But and so I guess you would come in that camp that would say, look, you know, you got grocery stores, you don't need the animal. But if it was just you or them, how would you feel?
I'm not quite sure I understand.
Well, if you go to the Arctic, you know, mm-hmm. I think it, you know, of course people can get groceries, you know, but
right.
you have to be there to understand the importance of the whale to these people that live in this extremely severe and stringent condition.
Certainly.
We sent dedicated vegetarian Rebecca Shear up there, and I said, you're not going to be a vegetarian when you come back. And by golly, she wasn't, and she was glad.
Right. Well, and I work with the native population, and believe me, we talk about this a lot. And certainly subsistence, I don't have a problem with. I think that most Americans go to the grocery store, and even in the villages and in Anchorage, and they buy stuff off the shelves, and they have no idea the suffering that the animals go through to become hamburger and chicken and eggs and milk. And certainly if I lived in the Arctic, I might change my mind. But I could also just get lots of beans sent to me from Costco.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So,
hey, thanks. Thanks. I really appreciate, because I can tell you put a lot of thought into this.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate the sharing. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Kathy, thank you very much. This is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about extinction. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. Also, email talk@aprn.org. And it's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. We've got Margaret Williams of the World Wildlife Fund, Nancy Lord, author of Beluga Days, with us on Talk of Alaska. And Roy joins the program from Akiak. Roy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you. Very interesting subject. Since the politics have placed Alaska in the national spotlight with the development of offshore oil by the big corporations, and Sarah Palin in one of her statements mentions that the global warming is more of a natural process than a man-made process, and trying not to offend the big oil companies. And it really makes us people that are really environmentally conscious, wanting to preserve our subsistence resources versus those extreme developmentalist-minded people that may not be too aware of subsistence resources like we do. I'm trying to figure out how do you balance the politics of endangered species, you know, when this is such a big issue.
I don't think we got a good answer for that, but I do think that the science on climate warming is very clear, and it's deliberately put across as a consensus. So essentially, the people who say that human agencies are not responsible for the climate getting warmer are certainly violating the precautionary principle, and they're also going against what almost all scientists now agree on. So why are they allowed to keep getting away with that? You got me there, buddy. They just are.
Steve, these two species that we're talking about, polar bears and the Cook Inlet belugas, too, the state has been very active in disputing those or fighting the listings, which I think is rather an embarrassment because the science is clear in both cases, and it's a use of politics to override the science. And the very people who say, well, we want decisions made on sound science, except when they don't agree with the science.
Right. Yeah, but you know, politically. Because Endangered Species Act brings about federal jurisdiction, and historically states have, almost always opposed any kind of ESA listening. Oh, Margaret?
Oh, it's just going. I thought Roy's question was really great, and thinking about how to balance the concerns of the local communities and the pressures for offshore drilling, and I think he brought up the point of. Groups, sort of the extremist groups, and one of the things I just wanted to point out that was I thought was really neat last year when the International Whaling Commission met here in Anchorage, all of the environmental groups who work in Alaska and many of the groups who have headquarters in the East Coast got together and sent letters of support to Senator Stevens, Senator Murkowski, saying how important it was for the Alaskan native whale harvest to continue. And really supported that. So I think there is a balance actually that's growing between interests of the environmental community and local communities. And one of those places where the concerns come together is particularly in offshore drilling. We are facing, as I mentioned, you know, huge changes in the Arctic, and the proposal to add additional offshore drilling potentially will be adding more carbon resources, which is the very very cause of the ice melts and the climate changes. So it's kind of adding to the positive feedback loop, which is already underway. So it's kind of a mix of answers, but I really appreciated Roy's question.
Roy, are you still with us?
Yes, I am, and thank you for your response.
All right, Roy. Appreciate your call. We need to take a break, and when we come back, I want to, Nancy, ask you about whether you think the oil activity in Cook Inlet has anything to do with the demise of the belugas when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
It's Talk of Alaska. We have Nancy Lord and Margaret Williams with us. And Nancy, we are hearing about concerns about offshore oil activity. It's only understandable. It seems to be kind of a political football at the moment. And we've had oil and gas activity in Cook Inlet for many years now. Do you think this has had any impact on those belugas?
I don't know the answer to that.
I knew you were going to say that.
there's a lot going on in Cook Inlet, and the fact that the belugas are not the population is not recovering after the unregulated subsistence hunting was stopped indicates that there's something going on there. But there's no indication of that contaminants from the oil industry are at any levels in the animals that would be a concern. But the sad thing is that these, you know, whatever the cause of the population being depressed is, the research is not being done. There are, you know, many aspects of the life history of the animals and looking at all of the potential problems that they could be facing. And the research is just not being done, which is
one. Oh, yeah, I see. Maybe that argues for the ESA listing.
It does. That's one. If they were listed, there would be resources that would be spent on trying to figure out exactly what's going on with that population.
Oh, I see. So among other things, ESA listing can trigger a little bit more budgetary attention.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's go to David. Joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, David.
Yeah, good morning, Stephen, Dave Otness. I just got back from 3 months up in the areas being discussed in the Chukchi and the Bulford as well. And just for statistical purposes, I thought I'd mention to the guests that my last day up there, we went out to Cross Island. It's a whaling camp, and we delivered some supplies to the whaling camp, and there were 17 polar bears of mixed age groups, including cubs, everything all in one place, eating on the skulls that are lined up there. It's quite apparently a shared grounds, and Nuiqsut is the next outfit to go to work on their quota. And over the course of the summer, I think probably spotted half a dozen different bears in the area of this Liberty Prospect. And while stuck in the ice for 2 weeks west of Wainwright, we did observe with marine mammal observers aboard at least 10,000 walrus within 15 miles of the coast before the ice finally moved off. So just for your stats, that can be documented with the MMO management group that Veritas, the exploration company, employed.
All right, Margaret, kind of interesting observation.
Yeah, David, thanks. That's really interesting. It sounds like you've had a great experience in the Arctic. And I do know that polar bears it's not completely uncommon to see them on land, especially now as we get into September around Cross Island and Kaktovik as well. The community there is very accustomed to seeing bears on land. I've spent quite a lot of time in Russia, where in one community they experienced almost 200 bears in their vicinity. That was actually very unusual. That was in 2006. Last year it was not repeated, and they're getting ready for possibly more bears on land. So I think those kinds of sightings are going to increase. I know when I was in Barrow 2 weeks ago, there had been a bear actually swimming in the freshwater lagoon. I believe he was inadvertently frightened closer to town and swimming around in the lagoon. So it's going to be really important for communities to work together, and I hope World Wildlife Fund can assist with this to think about how do we get ready for increasing human-bear interactions and how do we protect people and also protect the bears, because as they're going through this difficult transition with sea ice reduction, we need to think about all the things we can do to reduce disturbance and stress on the species, whether it's walrus or ice seals or polar bears. But that's really neat.
You know, one of the more frustrating aspects of my time up there without any break was the passage of Trans-Canada. We've got a huge issue on our hands here with all of this gas being pretty well dedicated to the tar sands of Alberta. And I think our legislature just totally swam off into the swamp of moral equivalency.
Wow. That's a really interesting observation.
On Valdez, and we're turning around, and we're gonna dump all this CO2 and make this huge mess in Canada. And I thank God people are waking up to it. You know.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, David.
And just you brought up Exxon Valdez, and that's, I suppose, a little bit of straying from your subject of extinction, Steve. But right now, going back to the Arctic, where we are facing just huge, huge changes, we really have to be thinking about setting a high, high standard for all kinds of development, including shipping safety. And some people say, well, why are you working on shipping safety? And the answer is easily said in two words, Exxon Valdez. And I'm glad you brought that up, David, because we have a very vulnerable set of species in the Arctic. We have vulnerable communities, and we've got to be thinking about what the potential impact of adding new oil and gas
in the offshore environment. Let me be blunt on the tar sands, however. This is a ridiculous thing in terms of the carbon output. You're basically putting almost as much energy, sometimes more energy, in than you're taking out. And yet we're seeing massive industry investment in this because there is no carbon tax. Let's go to Bob in Cook Inlet. Hello, Bob. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
How's the water there, Bob?
It's cold, Steve.
Ah.
Cold. But I appreciate the show, and I just want to say it's really important to focus on the Endangered Species Act, because there's a powerful myth in this state, and it's the myth that we have a rigorous permitting system. And we saw that really clearly in days before the Clean Water Ballot Measure 4, and we saw full-page ads with Governor Palin's face saying, "I vote no." And the reason she voted no is because we have very stringent regulations and policies already in place. Well, you can look just in Cook Inlet, and you see that that's a fallacy. For example, the Port of Anchorage is filling in 135 acres of beluga whale habitat, and all the major federal agencies, the EPA, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they all objected to the permit, but the Army Corps granted it. Similarly, you can look at the Cook Inlet oil and gas facilities. The Environmental Protection Agency granted a permit in 2007 that allowed them to triple their toxic discharges in the beluga whale habitat.
All right. Thank you, Bob. We're running out of time.
Good call.
Okay, sorry. Thanks, Steve.
Good comments.
Beauregard and Homer, I'm so sorry we couldn't get to your call. I think it would have been interesting, and I was really hoping to get some meditations on how do you really come down if it's just, you know, if it's your livelihood versus extinguishing some species, what is your answer? Because I'd like to know how people feel. Nancy, Lord, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks, Steve. Thanks for the opportunity.
And Margaret, good to have you back.
Thank you. And where else but in Alaska could we be having these discussions about all these incredible species? So we've got to do our best to keep them around.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to Annie Feit for doing the phones today. Emily Butler, Duncan Moon's our managing editor, and this Gooseberry Peter on the controls. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
the Alaska Community Foundation, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Your local public radio station has airtimes.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.